Good morning. It's better to purchase a losing lotto ticket than a jackpot winner. You say, Hawks, you've completely lost your mind. Like, we knew it was coming. People get in their 50s, they lose their mind. You know, we knew it was coming. Like, what in the world? Well, what I just shared with you is what I would classify as a conundrum. If you look up what a conundrum is in your dictionary, a conundrum is a puzzle or a riddle or a statement that has as its answer something in the form of conjecture. And so sometimes we hear something and we kind of have to think about it. And when you think about it, it kind of begins to take on a new form, maybe make a little bit more sense than what you would expect when you first hear it. So let's take this case in point. I said that purchasing a losing lotto ticket is better than purchasing a jackpot winner. Now, if you want to validate that, just look at the people who have won the multi-million dollar prizes. By and large, as a group, most of them would say, my life's demise began when I won that pot of money. The Proverbs even speaks to the issue of getting rich quick. What happens to people when all of a sudden they come into a lot of money? And so it may be the worst possible thing that could happen to you to all of a sudden have a couple million dollars land in your bank account, even though it seems like it would be the best thing that would happen. So then you would ask the question further, so why would it be better to actually purchase a losing lotto ticket? Why wouldn't it be better to just not buy one at all? Well, here's the reason. Because when you purchase a losing lotto ticket, and you lose, you get frustrated with the process, which kind of makes you think, why would I keep doing this? And then you'll save the money next time. So the whole thing may actually just be the best thing that could happen. Now that's kind of looking at life, not just so much through the front end, the hope, what could be, but kind of looking through the back end. What happens to people? What is? It's a conundrum. And Solomon is going to introduce us to a series of conundrums, statements that defy conventional wisdom, but when you peel them back and look at it in the form of life that we're talking about, they make a lot of sense. And so if you got a Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. If you don't, you might want to pick one up. We've got some on the sides around the room, or if you have some kind of electronic device that can actually go online, we have wireless in here. You can pull down the Bible from BibleGateway.com and look at it that way. We want you to have a Bible capable, be able to look at and follow along, and you can check your Facebook while you're doing that because your status may have changed in the last few minutes, especially of this lottery ticket thing. So you're kind of wondering about that. When we come to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, there's been a big shift in the book. In the first six chapters, Solomon has been laying out his life, kind of telling us, here's my experience. And what Solomon says is that God gave me wisdom, and then my dad gave me a kingdom, and I took those two tools, and I used them to indulge every possible fantasy of my heart, from music and art to building incredible places to live in, to creating gardens, to trying my hand at economics and building a fleet of ships that sailed the world bringing stuff back, to trying my hand at military conquest, to trying my hand at conquest with women. I did it all. I tried everything. Nothing that I could ever, if a thought went into my head, hey, that might be fun, or that might be cool, or you might like it, I tried it, he said. And the conclusion of the whole thing is he uses a Hebrew word that's translated meaningless or vanity. Now, the word meaningless means that it's short-lived and it doesn't accomplish much. And what he says is every human endeavor under the sun, every human endeavor that we would attempt to do apart from God, just doing life, every human endeavor, no matter what it is, will be short-lived. And it won't accomplish very much, limited accomplishment. And so Solomon said, why have I spent my life knocking myself out, being worried, striving, trying to accomplish things that at the end of the day, they don't really produce very much, and then I'm going to die. So by the end of chapter 6, he's kind of come to a place where he's got these really big questions. Chapter 6, verse 12, he asks two of them. He says, "For who knows what is good for a man in life? Who knows that? During the few and meaningless days, he passes through like a shadow. Who can tell you what is good? What's the right way to live? Who can tell you that?" And then he asks the second question, "Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he's gone?" In other words, who's got the future? Who can predict the future? Or who can predict whether my life will actually have meaning after I'm gone from this place? He's asking a who question because he hasn't found anybody human living under the sun, poet, philosopher, scholar, musician, hadn't found any builder, any general, any leader, hadn't found anybody that can give him an answer to those questions. And we said, when we talked about this passage, that he kind of came to the conclusion you got to look above the sun. You got to look to an outside source, something supernatural to answer those questions. So the question is, what is good? What does that look like? And in chapters 7 through 12, he's going to tell us. So for those of you who've been saying, I'm depressed in the first six chapters, I need something to do. Might not be good, but I need something to do, okay? It gets my mind off my depression. He's going to start giving us something to do. And he starts off with the concept of wisdom. He says something that's good under the sun for people to get is wisdom. Now here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to open up your mind to the possibility that you don't already know everything. And maybe even in the possibility to be able to say to yourself, maybe some of what I hold dear to me is actually not right. Maybe it's just not even right. And if you're willing to do that, you may hear some things from God's word today that will set you on a course that will give your life a lot more value and productivity and joy and happiness. So are you willing to give it a try? Just give it a try, okay? Open your mind up. So he tells us in this passage, first of all, that wisdom is a puzzle. Wisdom is a puzzle. In the first 10 verses, he gives us a list of conundrums that force us to actually ask the question, is the conventional wisdom that we believed, and that, in other words, is the majority opinion or the cultural view, which would be buying a winning lottery ticket is always better, right? That cultural view, is that really true? Or is that really not true? So I'm going to give you his conundrums. The first conundrum he raises, funerals better than birthday parties? Funerals better than birthday parties? Of course not, right? Look what he says in verse 1. He says, a good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. So he compares the good name with the day of death. He compares fine perfume with the day of birth. What's he saying here? He's saying this. He's saying oftentimes we get so wrapped up with potential that we miss progress or achievement. For example, what does perfume do? It makes a good first impression, right? So you walk in the room sporting your Old Spice. People smell the Old Spice. They wish their man could smell like you. And you make a good first impression. And let's face it, in American culture today, we live on that basis. Making a first impression is the most important thing, right? But a name, a good name, in the Hebrew context, was something that was cultivated and built over a history of a lifetime. That people's family names meant something because each person came along and would live out character, perseverance. In other words, at the end of your life when you're dead, then everything's accounted for and your reputation's intact. And so here's what we do. The baby's come into the world. We need to have a baby shower. We need to have a party. By the way, don't invite men to baby shower. Just saying, okay? We have a baby shower, we have to have a party, everybody has to experience this because we are so excited about this child coming into the world, but the child is just being born. We don't know whether this child is going to be an Olympic athlete, the president of the United States, or a mass murderer. We have no idea. But we celebrate potential. We celebrate the joy of what could be. Seldom do we go to a funeral thinking, this is going to be an opportunity for me to honor this person's life and their good name. We don't want to look at the end. We don't want to be confronted with the end. And so Solomon goes on. He says, in verse 2, he says, it's better to go to the house of mourning. It's better to go to the funeral than to the house of feasting, a party, for death is the destiny of every man, and the living should take this to heart. We need to stop from time to time and pause and recognize that this life that we're living has an ending. And so he challenges us, verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter because a sad face is good for the heart. Going through grieving forces the heart to deal with realities that are not dealt with at parties. They're not dealt with during gaiety, during fun times, when people are just having a blast. He goes on to say in verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. The heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. Interesting contrast. What he's telling us here, listen, he's telling us that party life, fun, going out, doing things that are going to make me jolly, amusement, all of those kinds of things, those kind of things, as much fun as they might be, very seldom cause us to reflect on what the really important issues of life are. And some of us perfect the art of never having to think deeply because we stay at the surface in the games of fun. We live in the house of pleasure, where everything's about me enjoying my day. And what Solomon says is, no, listen, if you would attend a funeral on a regular basis, it would do more for your soul and change the way you think about life than it would if you go to a party every week. I remember the first funeral I ever went to. I was a kid, upper elementary school. There was a kid a few years older than me in our church. He got a brain tumor and ended up passing away after a series of problems. And I just remember my dad taking me by the hand, and we were walking down the aisle of the old DeWitt Funeral Home in Michigan as we walked up to what I realized as we were getting closer was a casket, and there Donald was laying in that casket. And it was just an overwhelming moment. I didn't have any idea that that's what was going to happen. And he'd had a brain tumor, so he'd had surgery. He didn't look like himself. And I just remember standing there in horror looking into his face. Now, I went to a lot of parties as a kid, and I don't remember any of them. But I remember that day, and the thought that went through my head as an upper elementary age kid was, one of these days, I am going to be there, and I have no idea whether that will be sooner or later. That stuck with me. That has colored my life. I've had to deal with the reality that I'm not going to live forever, and I don't know how long that is. It forces you to ask the question, what am I doing today? And is what I'm doing today worthy of this precious 24-hour period that I have to live on this planet? Solomon says, that's actually good for us. So we ask the question, where's your heart today? Where does it run to? Does it run to fun, frivolity, lightheartedness, entertain me, make me happy, make me laugh? Or do you find it on the detour from time to time into the serious business that I only have one life, and I don't know how much of it I have, and so therefore I need to think deeply? So the question, funerals better than birthday parties? Maybe. Maybe. The second conundrum he raises here is as bad as the first one. Harsh teachers better than fun friends? Harsh teachers better than fun friends? Obviously not. We would much rather have fun friends than have a harsh teacher. Look at what he says in verse 5. He says, it is better to heed a wise man's rebuke than to listen to the song of fools. Now, that phrase, rebuke, there is an important word. Rebuke does not refer to the general wise sayings of a teacher or a wise man who would speak in general about life, and you'd go, I need to ponder that. That's really good. That's not what the word rebuke refers to. What the word rebuke refers to is somebody specifically looking you in the eye, identifying some behavior or attitude that is within you, correcting you by telling you what you're doing or thinking is wrong, and has the added tone of, I'm disappointed in you. That's harsh, right? In contrast to that, the Song of Fools that he's talking about here, that we find from verse 4 in the house of pleasure, is the kind of frivolity of, I'm okay, you're okay, we all accept each other, we're not going to go deep here, we're not going to go hard here, we're just going to indulge ourselves, we're going to have fun, we're going to enjoy it, we're just going to be fun friends. I'm not going to change you. You're not going to change me. In fact, if you start that stuff, we're not singing together anymore, okay? We're just going to have fun. And what he compares that attitude to in verse 6 is like the crackling of thorns under the pot. So is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. When you build your fire to cook your food and you put the raw meat and the raw vegetables in the water to make your stew and you have to go out and gather wood to put the fire together to cook the food, what do? Well, you can go out and grab the fastest, easiest things that you don't have to cut that are already dry, they're ready to go. That would be the thorn bushes. Put those under the pot, light them up, they crack, they spark, they make a lot of light, and they last for just a few minutes. And what you're going to eat that night is raw, cold stew. Or you can do the hard work of going out and cutting wood and splitting it up and building a lasting fire that will actually provide nourishment. And what he's saying is, wise people who are willing to tell you the truth about you, and a person is willing to listen to that truth and incorporate it in their life, to hear it and change on the basis of that, those people nourish your life. Fun friends, they come and go. They're okay, but they're not going to make a lasting impact. So the question is, who has your ear? Who is it that speaks truth into you? Who's the person who looks you in the eye and says, you know, I've been watching you. I'm really disappointed. Who is that person? You say, well, I don't have any of those people. Like, where are those people? Well, some of them may actually be in your life, but you know what happens? Wise people, once they say that to you and they get stiff-armed because they're wise, they think to themselves, I'm not going to waste my time. And so they quit telling you. So be very thoughtful when somebody comes to you, looks you in the eye, and gives you something of value, even if it's hard. That may be exactly what you need to hear to redirect your life in the right direction. So, harsh teacher, better than fun friends? I guess that's a possibility, isn't it? The third conundrum he gives here is later, sooner than later, better than sooner? You've got to be kidding me. Why would I ever want to wait for anything? How could later ever be better than sooner? He gives three examples of how that works out in verses 7 through 9. Let's look at them. First of all, in verse 7, he says, extortion turns a wise man into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. So getting money sooner, by extortion or bribery, rather than working for it? So taking the shortcut that puts you in a position where you compromise your values in order to get money? He says, that actually ruins the heart of a wise man. Even wise people can fall into that trap. Later is always better than sooner here. The second one, very interesting, he says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. So starting something, the beginning of something, and the ending of something, the end of the matter is better than the beginning, is compared to pride and patience. And we get that, don't we? Whenever a new project is starting, it starts with a lot of bluster. I mean, we're going to go out and we're going to create a new computer chip, or we're going to go out and we're going to win the gold medal in men's basketball. for those of you who watched yesterday. Or we're going to go out and we're going to have this incredible marriage that's going to be just the talk of the town. Everybody's going to see our love and see how wonderful we are. We're going to have this child. We're going to raise this child to change the world. In the beginning, it's easy to be prideful, to have confidence that what we're beginning here is going to be really good. But what does it take to complete something? It takes a lot of patience, doesn't it? Perseverance, hard work, sticking to it every day. People have a tendency to start things because that's the easy thing to do. It's the fun thing. It's exciting. It looks cool. I want to talk about the sooner part of this. But there are very few people in life that consistently finish what they've started. So that's why this weekend, when your spouse said, hey, I've got a great idea. Let's start a new home improvement project. And you're thinking, we started one last week and the week before and the week before. Can't we ever finish anything? It's no fun to finish anything. I don't get new tools by finishing stuff. I get new tools by starting a project and needing a tool for it. After I've used it for 15 minutes, I find out it's still work, right? It's still hard. This cool new tool is just a tool. So there's this idea that finishing later, patience, perseverance, is a better quality than the pride of starting. He gives one more here. It's really good. He says in verse 9, do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. He's talking about a quick reaction, a sooner reaction, rather than letting something process to be a later reaction. And so whenever you get news or somebody talks to you or you have a circumstance that comes your way, how do you deal with that? What he's saying is that the sooner is a more risky response than the well-reasoned, thought-through later response. And he says something very interesting. He says that anger is not something that's produced by bad circumstances. Anger is something that is already present in the person. In fact, when he says anger resides in the lap of fools, that word lap, translated from a word that means bosom, it's the folds on the inside, and it really actually refers to the whole idea that this is who you are. In other words, when you poke a fool, the anger that's already in the fool is what comes out. Now, we have a tendency to talk about it the other way, right? Well, the guy cut me off in traffic. That's why I'm angry. The guy that cut you off in traffic, all he did was poke. Peace and love could have come out of you. Right? Could have. Oh, sorry, I didn't give you space to get in. I apologize. You're probably talking on your phone. It's probably a really important call. Peace and love didn't come out of you. Why? What comes out of you is what's actually already in there. So if you find yourself constantly struggling with first reaction as a reaction of anger, and you're thinking if the whole world would just get right, then wouldn't come out. What Solomon's saying is actually the poke, all that does is just reveal what's already in the person. So the sooner reaction oftentimes is a really bad reaction. Get rich quick, always be on the front end of starting things, reacting quickly to every circumstance that comes your way, those things aren't as good as the long-term implications of living your life in a wise way. So when we wrestle with that, we have to ask that question. Is later better than sooner? Or sooner better than later? Golf folklore has a classic story of two golfers. One of the golfers that was on the tour a number of years ago, a guy by the name of Bobby Cole, was known for his terrible temper, his terrible antics, and his terrible attitude on the golf course. And for those of you who don't follow golf, when a tour is taking place, they pair golfers up and they send them out in pairs to play the 18 holes. And so on one particular time in Augusta, playing in the Augusta tournament, Sam Snead was paired up with Bobby Cole. Well, now, Sam Snead had the ability to be a little bit edgy himself, and he was a little bit older at the time, and so they get paired up together, and Sam Snead was thinking to himself, this is going to be a terrible day, and sure enough, it turned out to be terrible. Bobby Cole was constantly talking bad, constantly discouraging, constantly angry, just constantly being himself, and finally, Sam Snead had enough of it. They came to one particular tee box on a par four that was a dogleg right. And so, you know, he came up to the tee box, and he basically hit his shot down the fairway safely past the tall pine trees that were on the right blocking the view of the green, hit it down the fairway, a safe shot to lay up to come and hit his next shot. Well, Bobby Cole, he reaches in his bag, he pulls out his 3-iron too, and he comes up to the ball, and he's about to do the same thing, lay it up safely, when Sam Snead said, well, son, when I was your age, I used to hit a drive, fade over those trees, and land on the green, but you probably can't do that. So, Bobby Cole throws his 3-iron back in his bag, pulls out his wood, and mumbling under his breath, I can do anything you can do, old man. And he gets up and he hits the most perfect drive with just the perfect fade, just fading perfectly, perfectly, headed right toward the green until it hit the top of one of those pine trees and landed in the deep rough. As the two golfers started heading toward their balls, Sam Snead turns and looks at Bobby Cole and says, oh, by the way, when I was your age, those pine trees were only shoulder high. Anger resides in the lap of fools. One more. Solomon says, today, better than the good old days? Today, better than the good old days? No way. That can't be, right? And look at what he says. He says, in verse 10, he says, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. He doesn't even bother to write a proverb. He just says that's stupid. Like at this point, he's written 9 proverbs about these really cool things. And then he gets to this one and he says, just shut up. Like, don't talk like that. What is wrong with you people? Why would you say that? You say, well, Solomon, it does kind of seem to make sense since I said it a bunch. It must make some sense, right? What Solomon is saying is that hope is by nature a forward concept. Hoping in the past is actually a little bit loony, right? The good old days are not that good, and they're behind us. Thank God for the History Channel. Sometimes you watch some of those shows about the Roaring 20s and the 30s and the 40s. You go, whoa, glad we're living today. That was a pretty rough time back then. Every generation and every day has its own set of challenges. Better to pour your energy into the challenges of today than to pine for a bygone era that you really don't remember what it was like. Because human nature hasn't changed. The problems of humanity have been consistent since the Garden of Eden. So he just says, listen, guys, don't waste your life looking for something that's gone. Move forward. Funerals better than birthday parties? In some senses, yes. Harsh teachers better than fun friends? Absolutely. There are times when that is the case. When it comes to sooner and later, later better than sooner? Yeah, there's some wisdom in that. And finally, today better than the good old days? Absolutely, it's the only day we have. Now, having said that, Solomon then begins to pull together kind of this idea of the value of wisdom. So if you've got your mind still open, Solomon hadn't said anything that closed your mind back up. Oh, no, Solomon, I can't take it. It's still open. I want you to wrap this up with these last few verses, just kind of seeing wisdom and how it works. He tells us in verses 11 through 14 that wisdom is actually a life preserver. It can actually play a role in a limited sense of saving your life. And it saves your life in two ways. First of all, wisdom offers protection. It offers protection. Look at verse 11. He says, wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Now, in Israel, an inheritance was the actual land that you inherited from the conquest that was passed down through your family. So it was not only the place where you lived, but it was also the piece of ground you worked. And he said, wisdom provides life. It's kind of a life preserver. It kind of provides protection for you by giving you a place to live. And then he goes on and compares it to money. He says in verse 12, wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. So money can pay for your doctor bills. Money can pay for a roof over your head, for an alarm system to keep you safe. Money can pay for the basic necessities of life. So money has value. It does good things for us. He says wisdom is the same way, very much like that. It can provide for you. But he goes on to say, but the advantage of knowledge is this, that wisdom preserves the life of its possessor. In other words, if the money's all gone, if there's famine in the land, if your land is not producing, wisdom gives you the understanding of how to work with those situations, and it can save your life, regardless of your financial state. He goes on to say, though, that wisdom also plays another key role and the most important role, and that is that wisdom offers perspective on life. And here's where he brings it all together. Look at what he says in verse 13. He says, consider perspective. Let's think about this. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? This passage is telling us that the ups and downs, the rights and lefts, the curves and the straightaways of life, the future is in God's hands. He goes on to say, when times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider, ponder. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, a man cannot discover anything about his future. What he's saying is that God has set up time and space and human life under the sun in such a way that there's nothing that we can do today that will 100% absolutely guarantee what will happen tomorrow. You don't know whether you're going to go into the office tomorrow and find out that the president of your company's been embezzling and everybody's laid off and you've not only lost your job, but any retirement or pension. You don't know whether that's going to happen to you tomorrow. You don't know whether the resume that you turned in is going to bear fruit or not. You don't know that. You don't know what the doctor's going to say about your health. Those are things you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I love watching the Olympics because what's so captivating about the Olympics is you watch these people who've spent 8 to 10 hours a day for the last 4 years preparing to do something and having no way to control what the other people might do. Having no way to know whether you might pull a hamstring in the 100 meter or whether the underdog, the person who's never even been heard of before, might break a world record in swimming. And so it's fascinating to watch because outside of those people who watch NBC earlier in the day, none of the rest of us actually know what's coming. We don't know. We can't predict the future. And what this passage is saying is that God has actually set it up this way. He set it up this way. Why did he set it up this way? Well, in Romans chapter 8, it tells us very clearly that from the curse, after Adam and Eve sinned, that God subjected all creation, that would be all life under the sun, to frustration. It's not going to work. It's going to be broken. And because it's going to be broken, what Solomon says here in this passage is when times are good, be happy. Be happy. Because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So tomorrow, if you go to work and that crummy job you have is still there, like, be happy. Oh, man, this is a great day. I got work. This is a great day. I got work. If the doctor simply pokes you and says, yeah, I'll lose a few of these, but other than that, you're clear. Go out and eat a hamburger or something. I mean, like, be happy about that, right? Be happy. Why on a good day would we borrow trouble from a potential future bad day? You know why we do that? Because we don't really believe that God controls the future. We don't really trust that it's in his hands and that the good days and the bad days are both under his control. He says, though, when you're having a bad day, consider. God is the one who has fixed the world this way. And there's a reason why God's fixed the world this way. Paul tells us that God fixed the world this way so that through the sin and brokenness of this world in which we live, we would not be looking to ourselves for our own salvation. We would not be looking to this life for all the satisfaction that it can provide. We would be looking outside of that. We would be looking up. We would be looking to God. In this world, we all face the reality of the termination of our lives in death. And as much as we want to make it seem nice, it's still real. Came across a book by a Yale professor, Nicholas Waldersdorf, and he lost his son, Eric, unexpectedly as a child in a very tragic way. And being a philosophy and religion professor at Yale, he pondered this and tried to process this through the Word of God. And as he did, he says these things in his book, Lament for a Son. He says, someone said to Claire, his wife, I hope you're learning to live at peace with Eric's death. He writes, peace, shalom, salam. Shalom is the fullness of life in all dimensions. Shalom is dwelling in justice and delight with God, with neighbor, with oneself in nature. Death is shalom's mortal enemy. Death is demonic. We cannot live at peace with death. When the writer of Revelation spoke of the coming day of shalom, he did not say that on that day we would live at peace with death. He said that on that day there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. And then he says this, I shall try to keep the wound from healing. In recognition of our living still in the old order of things, I shall try to keep it from healing in solidarity with those who sit beside me on humanity's mourning bench. We're never supposed to get comfortable with the brokenness of this world. We are always supposed to recognize that the broken hardships of this world point us to someone else who gave a son. From outside of this world to save the people who are in it. And we're going to come and celebrate the giving of that son at communion now. So I'm going to dismiss the servers to go and prepare the communion. And as they go, I just want to hold your attention for just a few more minutes before communion. You see, on the worst possible day in God's experience, he gave up his son to come into our experience so that it could become the best possible day for us. And when Jesus Christ took the brokenness of this world on himself and suffered for our sin, God was preparing a day to set nature in order, to remove our final enemy, the enemy of death, by removing sin from our lives. And that was accomplished in a supernatural way through Jesus Christ. That's the gospel. That's the good news. And what God is calling us to is to live in that good news each and every day. That we would not only embrace the fact that Jesus Christ is the one who can pay for our sins and put us in a proper relationship with God so that we enter the kingdom when we die, but also to live in such a way that in this life we are not looking to the things of this world, to the momentary experiences to fill us up. If we do, we'll find the same emptiness that those outside of Jesus Christ experience day after day. And so on good days, trust that God's given them to you. Be happy. On bad days, ponder, reflect I was never intended to live in this brokenness. This is a temporary issue. And in the midst of all of that, we begin to understand the meaning that Jesus Christ gives us life in the future and in this day, and we draw it from him. His word, his wisdom, his spirit, his mission. And that's what we live in. So as we receive communion today, the servers, you guys go ahead and make your way to the front. As the servers begin to serve, they're going to look you in the eye on the end of the aisle, and they're going to say, Jesus died for you, and you take the bread, take the cup, turn to the person next to you if you feel comfortable, pass that on. Jesus died for you in recognition. This Jesus Christ who gave his life to bring meaning into our lives. And I'm going to ask you to hold the communion, and we'll take it all together as a group at the end. So as we receive communion, this is God's intervention for us.